Welcome to Sojourner Truth Tuesday to Friday, 7 to 8 a.m. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you so very much for joining us. From Tunisia to Egypt to Yemen to Syria and now Jordan, get the latest news from rebellions spreading in the Middle East. And kicking off Black History Month, we have a controversial discussion on homophobia in the Black community. We will be joined by Columbia University professor Kendall Thomas. There's also breaking news out of Haiti. The government of René Préval has reversed their stand and have agreed to issue a passport to deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. We speak later in the show with President Aristide's lawyer, Ira Kurzban. We will also premiere our revamped Sojourner Truth headline news done in collaboration with Pacifica Radio's Eileen Alfandari and our weekly Earth Minute. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. You could follow Sojourner Truth on Twitter. Let me see you on Twitter at SoTrueRadio, SoTrueRadio on Twitter, and look for us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. We're very happy this morning to premiere our revamped Sojourner Truth headline news done in collaboration with Pacifica Radio's Eileen Alfandari. We were so determined to bring you headline news. We were doing it the old-fashioned grassroots way, collecting news headlines, and I would do the read for you in the morning. So we're really delighted to do this collaboration with our sister station, KPFA, Pacifica Radio's Eileen Alfandari. So let us go now to our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. A massive crowd estimated at up to 2 million people has gathered in and around Cairo's Tahrir Square demanding the ouster of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Al Jazeera reporter Jackie Rowland is with the crowd.
Previously, there was a plan mooted that they were going to march to the presidential palace, but the message that they're receiving from a number of leaders, including Mohammed al-Baradei, who gave a message live in a broadcast with the Arabia satellite channel, was that they should hold the square. So at the moment, we have this situation where it's really a large festive gathering in the square, the army providing security around the perimeter of the square, and at the moment, no signs of anything taking a more sinister or violent turn. The people that you find next to each other on the square, in other situations, you'd think that they would have nothing in common with each other. We have seen women wearing full niqab, dressed in black with their face covered, and just a few feet away, young men drinking from bottles of beer, people who really have very different values, religious values, for example, but who are all united in sharing this common belief that in the interests of the future of Egypt and in the interests of the Egyptian people, this one man, Hosni Mubarak, must go.
The demonstration marks a decisive rejection of Mubarak's appointment of a new vice president, Omar Suleiman, cabinet reshuffle, and offer to open a dialogue with the opposition. Opposition leader Mohammed al-Baradei said Mubarak must leave the country before the reformist opposition would start talks with the government. The army pledged not to confront protesters, effectively handing over the streets to them after they vowed to bring out 1 million people nationwide. Haiti's government says it's ready to issue a new passport to ousted former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide that would open the way for his return to the country after 7 years. Aristide has been living in exile in South Africa. The Interior Minister said Aristide has not requested a passport yet. Speculation that Aristide might return soared after ex-dictator Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier stepped off an Air France jet in January in a shocking return from nearly 25 years of exile. The United Nations Human Rights Office said it has offered Haiti assistance to prosecute crimes, including killings and torture committed under Duvalier. California Governor Jerry Brown used his State of the State address to urge lawmakers to put a measure on the June ballot extending temporary taxes. Brown cited the political upheaval in Egypt and Tunisia to make his point.
Democratic ideals and calls for the right to vote are stirring the imagination of young people in Egypt and Tunisia and other parts of the world, we in California can't say now is the time to block a vote of the people.
Brown is counting on balancing the budget by extending temporary taxes, coupled with deep cuts to education and health and social welfare programs. Assembly Republican leader Connie Conway said in response, Republicans stand united as the only line of defense for California taxpayers.
We must cut spending, and we must do it now. The people have made it clear. They don't want to pay higher taxes. Voters have rejected every tax increase on the last two statewide ballots. It's time for Sacramento to finally listen to the people.
The legislature has until March to call a special election. The final tally is in for campaign spending in the California gubernatorial race. Republican billionaire Meg Whitman spent a staggering $178.5 million on her failed bid for governor. She spent more of her personal fortune than any other candidate in U.S. political history, $144 million. Jerry Brown's campaign spent just under $36.5 million. Outside groups, mainly labor unions, spent another $26 million to help elect Brown. San Francisco State Senator Leland Yee says over 7,000 people already have signed his petition to condemn Rush Limbaugh for his crude impersonation of Chinese President Hu Jintao. The petition calls on Limbaugh to apologize for mocking the Chinese culture and asks his sponsors to pull their ads. Yee said he has also received racist death threats by fax and phone. One fax included a graphic of a pickup truck adorned with the U.S. flag dragging a noose.
In light of the Arizona situation, it is extremely important that we call out these death threats. I think secondly, I want to make it very, very clear to those individuals who are making those threats that despite those threats, that's not going to have any effect on my behavior.
San Francisco State Senator Leland Yee. I'm Eileen Alfandera. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on KPFK.
And our brand new news headlines, thanks to Eileen Alfandera, based up at KPFA. We are now going to go directly on the ground to Cairo, Egypt, where the largest protest thus far has taken place. Let's hear a report now from Al Jazeera.
Protesters in Cairo have been holding a mock trial of President Hosni Mubarak. The verdict in this crowd, a foregone conclusion.
We're calling on this regime to step down and calling on President Hosni Mubarak that we will not let anyone from his government be appointed.
All our lives we've been oppressed. We've always wished to speak and to demonstrate. We were always living in fear. Now we're all united Muslims and Christians.
The call for 1 million people to take to the streets to send a clear message to President Hosni Mubarak, go now. Along the protest route, the army has taken up position. Tanks are blocking roads. Soldiers are watching, waiting. It says peaceful protests will be allowed.
We call on you to preserve the resources and riches of your great nation and to stand up to any act of vandalism or sabotage. The armed forces are fully aware of the lawful demands raised by honest citizens, and the deployment of the armed forces to the streets is for your security and safety. Your armed forces did not and will not resort to the use of force against the great people of this great nation.
Thousands defied the curfew to ensure they would be part of the march. They camped out again in Cairo's main squares. State television has been broadcasting messages urging people to stay at home, not to get involved. Trains heading to Cairo have been stopped. Those who've made it to the capital have been searched. President Mubarak wants to show he's moving on. His new cabinet has held its first meeting. His new vice president says he will open talks with all political parties. The aim, constitutional reform, including free and fair presidential elections, open to all. Pro-Mubarak supporters have taken to the streets, but their numbers can be measured in hundreds rather than thousands. He has promised changes, but for those hitting the streets in Cairo and across Egypt, it's not enough, and it's come too late. Alan Fisher, Al Jazeera.
and a report of what's happening on the ground in Egypt, in Cairo today. The revolution in Tunisia earlier this month that ended the two-decade rule of dictator Ben Ali has had a profound impact throughout the region. Demonstrations have occurred in Algeria, Yemen, Jordan, Egypt, and the occupied Palestinian territories, where the demonstrators alike demand an end to corrupt authoritarian regimes and further call for immediate social, political, and economic rights. The recent uprising in Egypt attests to this new era of revolutions, as the Egyptian people are calling for the immediate end of President Mubarak's nearly 30-year rule. The Egyptian government has tried to discredit the protesters by installing curfews and have either censored or completely shut down means of communications and social networks such as Facebook and Twitter. Security forces have been deployed, and reports of rubber bullets and water cannons have led to clashes that have resulted in many wounded, and we really don't know how many deaths thus far. While President Mubarak has tried to appeal to the people by dissolving the government and introducing subsidies, protesters defiantly continue to demand that Mubarak step down. As the world watches and as world leaders convene, Egyptian protesters appear adamant in their demands and show no signs of subsiding in the next days. And on the line with us from Cairo, Egypt, I'd like to welcome Philip Rizik. Philip, thank you so very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Philip is an independent blogger and filmmaker based in Cairo. He's editing video of some of the most critical parts of the protests and reporting on the Egyptian government apparently releasing criminals against protesters, looting, the lack of police protection, and other critical events. Philip, you are on the ground. Today was the Million People March, as it was called. Do you think they achieved those numbers? And what went on in Tahrir Square today?
I mean, honestly, it's very hard to estimate numbers. Some of the people I was with said the numbers were massive, something anywhere between 1.5 million to 2 million. All I can tell you is the streets that I usually drive through were filled with people from beginning to end. You can't see the end of the street. You can't see the end of the masses. And as you reported earlier, they're all united with one call: Hosni Mubarak must go.
Right. And also, you know, people here and indeed across the world are trying to grapple with what all of this means. Now, it was reported this morning that as a result of protests in Jordan, King Abdullah has now announced a shakeup, a reshuffling of the government there. Do protesters on the ground have some sense of the ripple impact that's going on now as a result of what they're doing?
Of course, these people know what the effect is. I mean, one thing that needs to be clear is that this region is interlinked. What happened in Tunisia is not independent of what's been happening in Egypt and protests that have been ongoing in the West Bank and Palestine for years and years and years. In Egypt, we've had labor strikes starting in 2006 of 20 plus thousand people. And these protests do make it into the news and affect the region. Tunisia was very incredible. I mean, this was a people movement. But Tunisia is a small country. What's happening in Egypt is foundation. It's fundamental. It's a fundamental change of the picture. And this is not just a people that, or a crowd, a multitude that is standing up and saying no to it, to a dictator of 30 years, but they're saying no to the policies that this dictator has imposed. So they're also saying no to the policies of the West. I mean, what they're so antagonistic against is not any different than it is in Tunisia, as it is in Morocco, as it is in Yemen, or Palestine, or Jordan. These are structural adjustment issues. They're economic issues that are directly imposed by the IMF and the World Bank, Western governments. This is what's causing food prices to go through the roof. This is what's permitting governments in these countries to keep labor, to keep income low, and it's causing populations to suffer while dictators are propped up for years and years and years using violence and torture to impose this rule. That's what populations across the region are saying no to.
right, excuse me. Also, tell us about the income gap in Egypt, which is quite wide.
I'll tell you about the income gap. Up until 6 months ago, the official minimum wage in Egypt was 35 Egyptian pounds per month. That in dollars is about $8 a month. Okay, $8 a month. This was the official minimum wage. Now there's hardly anybody that's making quite that little. The number hadn't been changed since 1982. But most people that are working are making anywhere between $70 to $150 a month. With prices today that are affected by the international markets, because again, Egypt is opening its markets to the international community. It's opening markets to imports, it's pushing for exports, tying the Egyptian economy to the world economy. People simply cannot survive. They cannot survive on this kind of an income. And they have had it. They have had it with this government. Even if people don't understand quite all the structural implications of why the conditions are this way, they are blaming the government. They're blaming the government. Already in 2008, we had protests. Those protests were more specifically around food prices. Again, there was a nationwide strike. There was a worker town in the Delta that had an uprising. Security forces crushed that uprising. Today, those security forces are outnumbered, and they have disappeared off the streets of Cairo. And the regime is trying, in the eyes of the West and the international community, to pretend to continue this rhetoric of providing for a people, providing stability, providing food. These are pure lies. This is propaganda that's coming out of the state apparatus. They're trying to reimpose the same regime. They're trying to reimpose the same standards and the same conditions that have exploited Egyptians for years and will continue to do so if change doesn't happen. What's happening today on the street in Egypt is what in America is so often talked about as democracy. So I don't know why this is so hard to understand. This is people on the road, on the streets, saying their opinion and saying no to a dictatorship and to an exploitation of a dictator.
Absolutely. And of course, in Yemen, demonstrations have been going on. Protesters have marched to the Egyptian embassy. There have been clashes with plainclothes police officers, according to Al Jazeera. In Jordan, people are also protesting rising prices, inflation and unemployment, and it's pushed the Jordanian king to action. And Al Jazeera is also reporting that Syria is watching very closely. And at some point on Friday, they had also shut down communications. But your information, Philip Rizik, about the economic oppression, really, of people there. I mean, we're seeing that. Egypt is part of the continent of Africa, and we're seeing that throughout Africa, throughout the Middle East, and many countries of the global south. But so what is happening in Egypt may have global implications.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. The condition isn't any different in the rest of the continent as it is here. Egypt just had its moment. I mean, there's activists on the street that have been pushing for this kind of an uprising for years, and there's been no momentum. There simply wasn't any momentum, and there's disagreement in the left. There's bickering about who is going to lead this uprising. What happened on Friday wasn't led by the left. It wasn't led by internet activists. Sure, people played a role. Sure, protests in the past have created some sort of a spirit, some sort of an atmosphere for protest. But what happened on Friday was a moment that just happened. And Tunisia played a role in that. The prices right now in the current situation have played a direct role in that. And the moment was right. And that moment could come to any country across the region. We don't know when. I mean, who could have expected Tunisia? Why now?
Right. Or Yemen. Who would expect Yemen? And well, what is the, we're going to need to wrap this up, but we're going to come back to you, Philip Rizik, as clearly things are going on. Do you think that people will accept anything less than Mubarak resigning? And what is the situation now on the streets, as far as you could imagine? It's night there now, is it?
It's not quite night yet. The streets are still packed. I just came back from Tahrir Square, where the masses There's masses out on the street, and they will not budge. And this is everyone's call until Hosni Mubarak goes. It would have been impossible to make these kind of a statements on that street just 1 week ago. Impossible. But here you're having it from 5-year-olds to 80-year-olds out on the street with the same single demand. And the thing is, we've lived under dictatorship for 30 years. The opposition is not very well developed. There has not been political freedom to mobilize, to create some, to establish any sort of true opposition. So it's really created a political vacuum. So we'll have to see what the next few days, weeks, and months bring about. But one thing is sure, nobody wants that regime back in power.
Right. Well, we live in indeed very interesting times. My personal note is I find it very encouraging. And Philip Rizik, later in the show, we're going to be talking to the lawyer of Haiti's deposed president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, because of international pressure. The Haitian government has just issued him a passport. So that's a hot spot happening here in the Americas. We're going to be watching very carefully. And I'm sure that they are monitoring as carefully as they can what's going on in Egypt and other parts of North Africa and the Middle East. Thank you, Philip Rizik, so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are going to take a very short break. When we return, we're kicking off Black History Month. It is February 1st. We're going to be having a controversial discussion about homophobia in the Black community. Later in the show, we are going to return to the uprising, the revolutions happening now in the Middle East, and focus specifically on its impact on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we will be talking to the lawyer of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. There is breaking news in relation to the Haiti's deposed president. We'll be right back. Africa, unite, 'cause we're moving right out of Babylon, and we're going to our father's land. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man, yeah, to see the unification of all. And Bob Marley, Africa Unite, I'm sure having very new meaning this morning. Al Jazeera is reporting 2 million people in Tahrir Square in Egypt as protesters continue to take a stand. And we're going to be returning to the conflict in the Middle East later in our show. But right now, we're going to turn our attention to the issue of homophobia in the Black community. Ugandan gay rights leader David Keito was brutally killed in his own home just last week. Local officials say there is no connection between his sexuality and his murder, but his friends and supporters disagree. In 2008, a United Nations declaration to decriminalize homosexuality was signed by only 6 African nations. The International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex organization noted that 38 African nations have homophobic laws. In several northern Nigerian states, men found guilty of homosexuality are punishable by death. Homophobia is also widespread in the Caribbean island nations, and some gay rights activists have called for a boycott of Jamaica, called the most homophobic place on earth by Time magazine in 2007. And here in the United States, homophobia is still rampant in the African-American community, included but not limited to the Black church. So what are the barriers to accepting the human and civil rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people in the African diaspora? Are Black and other people of color more homophobic than other populations? And here to shed some light on all of this to us, I would like to welcome Columbia University Law Professor Dr. Kendall Thomas. Dr. Thomas, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's Professor Thomas, by the way.
Professor Thomas, okay. Professor Thomas has written about issues of law, race, and sexuality, and have addressed the issue of homophobia and transphobia in communities of color. His contributions to The House That Race Built, edited by Wanima Lubjano, and Transgender Rights. He is the Nash Professor of Law at Columbia University and the Director of the Center for the Study of Law and Culture. He teaches constitutional law, human rights, critical race theory, and law and sexuality. So with all of that under your belt, we're very happy to have you and get your response to the disturbing news coming out of Uganda with the murder of the activist there, David Kaito, and your reflections on this issue in black communities here in the United States.
Well, the murder of David Kaito was tragic, to say the least. He was a highly regarded human rights activist, and I think all friends of human rights should be saddened when someone who is simply standing for the principle that all human beings, by virtue of their humanity, deserve basic rights, is cut down as David Kaito was. But I think it's important to remember that the situation in Uganda, the ideological and political climate that produced the kind of hate speech that led to David Kaito's death, is a climate that was created in part by Americans, specifically by white, right-wing, evangelical Christian Americans. I'm thinking in particular of the Holocaust revisionist and anti-gay activist Scott Lively, who actually has had the gall to claim that David Kaito was quite possibly killed by a gay lover and not by anti-gay elements in Uganda. But, Margaret, I really think it's equally important to take some care to make distinctions among black communities. There's a sense in which it does make sense, in light of some of the facts that you mentioned in your lead comments, to talk about the problem of homophobia in the black community globally. But there are also important distinctions, because different countries and different cultural contexts in the African diaspora have importance that we ought not overlook. I think one of the crucial things that we have to keep in mind in thinking about Uganda, Africa in particular, is that we're seeing the legacy of colonialism here and of the internalization of a legal system brought to Africa by Europeans, which criminalized homosexuality, indeed, which introduced the idea of homosexuality. Historically, in many traditional African societies, same-sex relations were not only tolerated, but recognized.
Really? A lot of people don't know that.
And a lot of people don't know that. So the line pushed by Winnie Mandela and other activists in Africa that homosex is not in the African tradition is simply flat wrong as a matter of history. And I think we in the United States, primarily through the vehicle of black cultural nationalism, have also come to believe that homosex is not in the black African tradition.
Yeah.
There's a long and rich and vibrant presence of same gender loving people in the African American community who have made signal contributions to the freedom struggle of African American people. Audre Lorde, Bayard Rustin, to just name a couple of,
right.
of people. So we have to ask then, what are the analogs in the U.S. context to the kind of internalized colonialism that I've suggested is part of the cause of the situation in Uganda and other African countries? Well, quite frankly, I think we in the United States, I'm speaking here in particular of African Americans, have internalized white racism and the demonization of black sexuality that was historically and in many respects continues to be part of the way black identity and black life and black communities get represented in the white American imagination. And I think it's crucially important, A, to acknowledge that fact, and B, to realize that there is unfinished work that African Americans have to do, which has to do with freeing ourselves from these racialized chains, really, that have been imposed on the way we think of ourselves as people who are capable of loving, of as people whose sexual desires are healthy. And it impacts the way I think that we interact with one another. We relies well on these ideas of tradition and religion. Barack Obama famously said a few years ago, when he was still a senator, in an interview in the Chicago Tribune talking about gay marriage, that tradition and his religious beliefs teach him that marriage is an institution between that recognizes relationships between a man and a woman. Well, I think it's important to realize that religious belief, religious community, religious affiliation is one thing. But if we're talking about public life, black public life, and American public life, we have to take the idea of diversity that we claim to be committed to seriously and really ask ourselves some hard questions about whether or not the reliance on these ideas of tradition or religious belief are an adequate justification for denying the equal citizenship of people simply because they're different in their sexual practices and in their intimate associations and in the kinds of choices that they make.
Right now,
who they love.
Professor Kendall Thomas, I'm afraid we just have about a minute or so, and I found it ironic that in the prop the Yes on 8 campaign here in California, the right-wing funders were successful at mobilizing the black church to use their sermons as a place to urge members to vote against the rights of LGBT marriage equality, which is ironic because all of us who have any familiarity with the black church know that there's all, you know, everybody knows in the black church who's gay, whether it's the organist, the priest, or whoever, and people are quietly accepted. They, you know, just don't want to shout about it. So I'd like you to talk a little bit just very briefly about that. And do you think that some people have said that it's racism in the gay rights movement was a contributing factor to the division between people of color and the gay communities?
I think it doesn't make sense any at all to play the race card here. I think we need to be having a frank conversation about the corrupting influence of money, because a lot of money came from powerful white interests into black churches, primarily into the hands of black preachers.
Yeah.
And we need to be talking about hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Because many of the very same people who are getting up in pulpits and are proclaiming the evil of homosexuality are engaging in sexual practices which, if they came to light, they would be run out of the church for. So we need to be looking at alternative spaces. I'm thinking of Bishop Yvette Flunder's organization, The Fellowship, which is, in the context of a black liberation theology, preaching a Jesus of justice, right? And demonstrating that, like racism was shown to be heresy in South Africa, homophobia and sexism are heresy, that black religious people, whether they're Christian or Muslim, can no longer defend on the basis of religious belief. Martin Luther King once said that the law may not be able to make a man love me, but at least it can keep him from lynching me. And I would say black religious people of whatever faith don't have to love gay men and lesbians in the black community or outside of it. But they have to be committed to and held accountable for the actions and statements that they make, which create the kind of climate of violence that led to the death in Uganda of David Kato, and which leads to acts of violence and, yes, even death every single day in black communities all over this country, directed against gay men, lesbians, and transgender people.
Right. Well, very well said. On that note, Kendall Thomas, we're going to be continuing that discussion, because certainly you have brought out some information that a lot of people don't know. And indeed, it is not true that homosexuality was a white disease, quote unquote disease brought into the black community. No such thing. And of course, it is everything that you have said to shed some light on this has been extremely helpful to that discussion.
Well, Professor, let's keep the conversation going.
Let's do that. Professor Kendall Thomas, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you. Goodbye now.
Bye. We're going to take a very short station break. Coming up, our Earth Minute. We're going to return to the revolution happening now across North Africa and the Middle East. Salman Abu Sita, Palestinian in exile, will be joining us. And also, we'll be talking to the lawyer of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. There is breaking news out of Haiti in relation to that situation there. We'll be right back.
Need to earn a couple extra college credits? Why not earn them at KPFK? If you appreciate progressive news, culture, music, and more, come and be a part of the movement. Call 818-985-2711, extension 513, to learn about internship opportunities. Or log on to kpfk.org and click on volunteer to find out more.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on the air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. And we will take care of everything. Seriously, it's that simple.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
Yes! Yes, this little song here is called Old Pirates, you know, redemption song. Old pirates, yes, they're rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my end was made strong by the end of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing another song of freedom? Is all I ever have. Redemption songs, children. Redemption songs. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery.
And the man Bob Marley, redemption song. We are living in what some people would call interesting times indeed. We're coming up, we're going to have our Earth Minute, and then we're going to be joined by Salman Abu Sita, a Palestinian now living in Kuwait, for him to weigh in on what is going on in Egypt now and the rest of North Africa and the Middle East. And later, we'll be talking with Ira Kurzban, the lawyer for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. There's breaking news out of Haiti. First, we're going to go to our Earth Minute. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio's KPFK, 90.7 FM in Southern California, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Streaming available for podcasts worldwide on the web at kpfk.org. Let us go now to our weekly Earth Minute. Two
Tomorrow in New York City, the UN will declare 2011 the International Year of Forests. Many forest protection and indigenous rights groups, however, are calling this ironic since forests today are falling faster than ever. Meanwhile, UN-endorsed climate strategies, including forest offset schemes that allow polluters to continue polluting, are rapidly making the problem worse. Forests are the cradles of biodiversity and the lungs of the earth. Their protection is vital if we are to successfully mitigate climate chaos. To truly protect forests, there are a few things we must do. We must stop converting forests to industrial timber plantations, which the UN, incidentally, makes no distinction between, which is kind of like calling a cornfield a prairie. We must address the demand for wood that drives deforestation. Unfortunately, timber companies and the UN are promoting a huge new demand for wood in the form of wood-based bioenergy. In addition to worsening climate chaos, this could result in the conversion of all forests to plantations within the next 50 years. To protect forests, we must ensure that the communities that depend on them remain their caretakers. But ultimately, we must address the underlying economic policies that treat the world's forests as mere commodities, instead of revering those forests for the life they sustain. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty, and that was our weekly Earth Minute. We are now going to turn our attention yet again to the revolution going on in North Africa. We're focusing on Egypt, but it's spreading throughout North Africa and the Middle East. Jordan, the latest, the president of the King Abdullah of Jordan, now saying that there's a shakeup of that government, and indeed a brand new government will be put in place. And Al Jazeera is reporting 2 million people on the streets in Cairo today. I would like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Salman Abu Sita. He is a Palestinian academic known throughout the world, had to flee his village when the State of Israel was set up. He was in school at the time, and I've heard the story of him having to travel from his school and his family losing their property and everything that they had in what was formerly Palestine. And Salman Abu Sita is based now in Kuwait. Salman Abu Sita, thank you so very much for joining us.
Good morning, Margaret. It's nice to be with you again.
Yes. Now, Salman Abu Sita, very exciting times happening. You likely heard now that in Jordan, there's a shakeup of the government there. King Abdullah hoping to avoid what is going on in Egypt right now. But we've got Yemen. We have Tunisia, Algeria, Jordan, Egypt. What do you think this might mean, especially focusing on Egypt, which is been such a strong ally of Israel in relation to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Margaret, we are seeing historic times. I could not imagine that people's power could be so forceful as to topple dictators and tyrants. We have not seen this probably since Bastille days in the end of the 18th century.
Wow.
Or perhaps we have seen it in South Africa. This is a historic moment when people's power alone, with no guns, with no ammunition, no F-16s, are able to assert themselves and claim their right in democracy and human rights. You know, this situation in Egypt now, which I know very well, I have studied there many years, actually is an example, it's of course a very big example, of two-thirds of the Arab world who are possible scenes for similar scenes. For example, we have seen this in Tunis and now in Egypt. Very probably Jordan is a candidate, so is Yemen. Two-thirds of the Arab world are candidates for that. And the reason for this, Margaret, if you allow me, is historical. Since the First World War, when two colonial diplomats, namely Sykes, the French Picot, and the British Sykes, gathered together to divide the Arab countries between them after they have victory over the Turkish Empire at the time. They promised the Arabs they will have democracy and freedom as soon as the First World War is concluded. Instead, they huddled in the room and divided the Arab world between them. Parts went to France and other parts to England, most of it to England, and of course part to Italy and so on. And so they installed puppet regimes. They had a deal with them, almost like Blackwater deal. You do what you like inside, provided you do our bidding for outside affairs and strategic matters.
Right.
And Mubarak is one such example.
Right. And Netanyahu and the Israelis are being very, very careful. They did say, however, that they asked their allies to be careful in their criticism of Mubarak. Now, those demonstrators clearly have no stop protesting until Mubarak goes. This is what I'm hearing again and again. And if Mubarak goes, what do you think that might mean then in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And do you think that Israel might be losing an important ally for them, for their cause?
Well, Netanyahu is now trying to frighten everybody else, everybody, especially the Western powers, saying that if Mubarak goes, the Muslim Brothers will take over and we will be in trouble. There are two issues here. Number one, Muslim Brothers will never be a majority. They will probably be a vocal opposition minority, but they will not be in power totally. Secondly, the grievances about the peace agreement, so-called peace agreement, between Egypt and Israel of 1979 may be brought to the fore. Let us remember that Sinai, which is a very big part of eastern Egypt, is still not independent. It's under diminished or truncated sovereignty. It's divided into four vertical segments. The eastern one, close to Israel, is 40 kilometers wide, and it has 1,600 soldiers, mostly American soldiers, monitoring the progress and monitoring the movement of everybody. Even Mubarak himself cannot go to Sharm el-Sheikh without permission. At least he cannot really move any soldiers there without Israel permission. So the grievance of the people would probably be, in the end, after their domestic affairs have been satisfied, is to ask, why is our country in the eastern part still doesn't have the sovereignty which it should have? How long this supervision and control of Sinai by Israel and the United States can continue? That is a very correct legal and international law grievance, but at the moment I don't think they are thinking about that for the time being.
Right, and we just have 1 minute, I'm afraid, so we're going to have you back because this situation will continue to grow. El-Baradei is being put forward as a possible replacement, Mohammed El-Baradei, and he certainly called the United States' refusal to openly abandon President Mubarak of Egypt a farce. Do you get a sense that there is some possibility of El-Baradei being put in place in Egypt, and what do you think that might mean?
I spoke yesterday and even this morning to quite a number of friends in Egypt, and they all agree on the following, that Baradei may represent the conscience, maybe represent the call for human rights, but he has no people's base, and he is not accepted by large segments as a ruler of the country. He may be accepted as a voice of conscience and a voice of reason, but he doesn't have the track record to be elevated into a position of high authority in Egypt. Still, he will play a good part, but I don't think it will be a major one.
Right. Well, on that note, Salman Abu Sita, based in Kuwait, a Palestinian living now in Kuwait, thank you so very much for joining us. And I'm sure we'll be speaking again very, very soon.
Thank you very much, Margaret. And I, as I speak, I see the Al Jazeera TV showing at least 1 or 2 million people clamoring for natural right, that is their human right.
Absolutely. 2 million are the reports we're getting from Al Jazeera. Thank you. Salman Abu Sita. This is Sojourner Truth, your host, Margaret Prescott. And we're now going to turn our attention to breaking news coming out of Haiti. And I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Ira Kurzban, who is the lawyer for deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. So, Ira, what's going on? Welcome, first of all. Yeah.
The president has requested his passport. The Haitian government has indicated that they will issue his diplomatic passport.
Wow.
And we have called on the government, consistent with Haitian law, to provide the president security. There was a law passed when there was the first democratic succession between President Aristide and President Préval, providing for how former presidents would be treated, and included in that, just as in our country, that the president would be provided security and so forth. So hopefully the Haitian government is working on those issues. The letter I sent yesterday was to both the Foreign Ministry and the Ministry of the Interior, asking that they issue the passport and that they make security arrangements.
Right. Now, it's interesting that you have already requested the passport for President Aristide. This has been a bone of contention for a very, very long time. There was a huge full-page ad in the Miami Herald, I believe, not the Sunday before last, signed by a number of prominent people, Paul Farmer, Harry Belafonte, Danny Glover, Oliver Stone, and many others, asking for the return of President Aristide that has been blocked for so long. But you have already made the request, and the government has said, well, if they get the request, they'll issue it. So what's happening? I mean, are you expecting them to issue it like any minute right now?
I hope so. I expect that they would. They said they would, and I take them at their word. I've known many of those people for many, many years. I think they're honorable people, and I think they will, if they've said it, they'll act on their word.
And we're
expecting them to.
Right. And following the issuing of the passport, I know security is a concern, and I'm not sure you know this, but another breaking story is that in the UK Parliament today, Member of Parliament John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn issued something called an early day motion welcoming the announcement by the government of Haiti that former President Aristide will be issued a passport and thus be able to return from exile in South Africa. They say they deplore the manner in which he was removed from Haiti and hopes his return will help lead to social justice and democracy for the people. So what exactly needs to happen now? And I know Haitian people are anxiously awaiting for President Aristide, his wife and children, to step off of that plane, finally back onto Haitian soil.
Well, I think the government of Haiti has to initiate a discussion with the government of South Africa and make the final arrangements for the president to return to Haiti. I think this is a government-to-government issue. You're dealing with the former head of state of Haiti, so the appropriate way to approach it would be for the government of Haiti through the foreign ministry to address that with the foreign ministry of South Africa. Of course, I don't need to tell them that. They fully well know what needs to be done, and that clearly is what needs to be done.
Right now, the situation is very fraught. I mean, you have now in Haiti former dictator, and brutal dictator, Baby Doc Duvalier, who is saying he intends to stay in Haiti. He has his own security. I understand that Chamblain, who is a CIA guy, frankly, and involved in the coup against President Aristide, is there providing some of the protection for Baby Doc. Jacques Duvalier. So, I mean, how do you think this will play out in terms of security? Do you think that there will be serious consideration given to the security of President Aristide? Because clearly there are a lot of people who see him as a threat and who might want to get rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of bad people who are walking around Haiti now who kind of come out of the woodwork and been brought back by the U.S. and French intelligence services and who are surrounding Baby Doc. And they do pose a threat. And I think the government of Haiti has to deal with them in one way or another. It's up to the government to do that. But, you know, none of these comparisons make any sense. I mean, Duvalier was a dictator. He was not an elected president. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was the twice elected president, the first time by 67% of the vote, the second time by 91%. As a former elected president of the country, he certainly has the right to come back, and he has the right under Haitian law, unlike Duvalier, to have the country protect him as a former president, just as we do with our own former presidents. They continue to have Secret Service protection, even though they're no longer presidents.
Right. And just in a little less than a minute, what do you think the turnaround was? I mean, because they were refusing to agree to issue this passport before. We know Hillary Clinton was there on Sunday. What do you think happened?
Well, I don't know. I think that's a question that really has to be asked of the government of Haiti. Certainly, there is a strong feeling if somehow Duvalier can come back, then how could it be that the democratically elected president of the country could not come back to his own country? And secondly, I think there's a real concern about, you know, the developments in Haiti since Duvalier has been back with regard to the people who are surrounding him and, you know, what that means for the future of Haiti.
Right.
And, you know, there's very few people in the country who have the status to be a counterweight to that, and he's one of them.
Right. Well, on that note, Ira Kurzban, this is very exciting news indeed. Full disclosure, I was also a signer of that letter asking for President Aristide's return. So we're going to stay on top of this story. So Ira Kurzban, please let us know of any other breaking news. Ira Kurzban, lawyer for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, with encouraging news. The president will be indeed issued a passport, it seems, to return to Haiti. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All righty. We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott, assistant producer Sarah Shakur. We'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth volunteer team, Wula Dawson, Jenny Francisco, Shawnee Miller, Eric Doyle. We'd also like to thank Arlene Elfenberry for our brand new news headlines, and of course, engineer Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow morning, and stay tuned for Uprising. Thank you so very much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Minutes after day took I from the bottomless pit, but my end was made strong by the end of the Almighty. We forward in this generation. Triumphantly, won't you help to sing another song of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have retained.